This is Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm Chris Nolte, and let's check in with Dan Carden, who covers typically Lake County news for the Times of Northwest Indiana. He's also done some election work, which we'll find out about in particular, but he's branched out because he covers Indiana politics so well, working with the State House and all in the past, and continues to do so. He's had a lot of stories here lately about Congressman Pete Visklosky. And first off, Dan, thanks for joining us on the show today.
Happy to be here.
Well, let's get in first to the big announcement, which may have been a surprise to some, but not apparently to everybody, that Pete Visklosky is, well, as the subhead calls it, calling it quits, although I don't necessarily think that's probably the case, is it?
Well, he is going to finish his term, so he's got the rest of this year and all of next year and then a couple days into 2021. So he's not leaving quite yet, but yeah, he is going to end his tenure overall at 18 terms. He's not going to run for re-election. That will actually make him, well, he's already the longest-serving House member in mm-hmm. Indiana history, and he'll actually end up tied with Dick Lugar for the longest-serving member of Congress from Indiana. Senator Lugar served 36 years in the Senate, and once he finishes his term, he also will be right at 36 years.
Let's talk a little bit about the announcement, which came out on Wednesday, which was the 35th anniversary, I guess you could say, of he being in Congress, wasn't it?
It was. I did not have that circled on my calendar, but apparently he did and decided that was the day to announce his forthcoming retirement. You know, you mentioned that it came as a surprise. I count me as among those who was surprised. I was mm-hmm. sitting at my desk the day after, you know, working all night covering the election the night before, and this email pops up from his congressional office saying, "Yep, I'm done." It's like, wow. Okay.
Well, I guess
my day.
I was thinking that we know, and it's part of the other part of the story we're going to talk about too. It involves Hammond Mayor Tom McDermott Jr.
Right.
But you know, because there was some talk and some discussion, I guess, about some interest, I guess, about possibly being involved in a congressional race. But that's part of the rest of the story, so to speak. Here, let's go ahead and continue on about what Congressman Visklosky has to say about his tenure in office. Certainly, it's not over, and a lot more can be done here. But I know he's focused in on some very important things in the 35 years, hasn't he?
He absolutely has. Of course, he's been probably the biggest defender of the steel industry in America, in the United States. Obviously, he has a parochial interest, given the importance of steel in his district. But, you know, he's also been focused on good trade agreements that don't undercut American manufacturing. And in recent years, he's obviously been extremely focused on the South Shore Line train, getting federal funds to expand that south from Hammond to Dyer, and then to double-track the main line from Gary to Michigan City, all of which is going to, according to supporters, speed commutes into Chicago and really better connect Northwest Indiana to this, you know, to the nation's third largest economy in Chicago, which you know, will presumably spawn a lot of transit-oriented development near the stations and mm-hmm. spill off development from that as well.
I know, too, that if you want to even go even further, just slightly to the east from Hammond and the counties closest to the state line and Chicago, he has a very close, I guess I'm thinking that the city of Gary is very close to his heart. His dad used to be a mayor.
Right.
And in turn, he does keep the city of Gary foremost in his mind a lot of times. And I know that before he really got involved here with the expansion on the South Shore Line, he was very much involved with Marquette Park, and the entire region there of Lake Michigan, wasn't he?
Right. And he had a hand in creating the Northwest Indiana Regional Development Authority. He worked with Chet Dobus at the State House to come up with this way to use some of the toll road money to fund these projects that, you know, the Whiting Lakeshore, the Portage Lakefront Park, the Marquette Park in Gary, and a lot of the recent sort of quality of life developments along the lakefront, as well as the work to improve the Gary Airport for whatever that's going to become,
mm-hmm.
All flowed through Visklosky's office.
I know there's been a lot of, I guess can be best described, and you did in the subhead, is the bipartisan praise for Pete Fisklosky. And it's probably surprising, not surprising from Democrats, but probably surprising from a Republican standpoint, too, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, Northwest Indiana, the first congressional district, is a pretty safe Democratic district. Republicans haven't competed particularly aggressively against Pete, and Pete has gone out of his way to work with Republicans. You know, it is a Republican-controlled state house for probably the last 15 years, except for a few years in there. And Governor Holcomb was one of the first people to praise him effusively, and I'm told the governor wrote this statement that we have in the Times today, wrote it himself, talking about how Pete delivered for Northwest Indiana and for the state, mentions the creation of Indiana Dunes National Park, which got done just earlier this year. This is a 120-year project to preserve the dunes as a national park. I mean, it was a national lakeshore, but this national park designation is bringing in a ton more visitors and really putting Northwest Indiana on the map as a place for people to visit and see and get to know and explore. So it's been quite a tenure in Congress.
Who are some of the other Republicans besides Governor Holcomb that had some nice things to say about Pete Fisklosky?
Yeah, Todd Young, Senator Todd Young, also had a lot to say, pointing out Congressman Fisklosky's advocacy for Northwest Indiana and his work alongside the congressman on the national park, on the South Shoreline. Todd Young was in the House, moved over to the Senate, and has really made – he's progressed into the Senate leadership. He is a Republican, but, he's clearly – of that sort of Joe Donnelly strain where you work across party lines to get things done for the people you represent.
Yeah, let's talk about the parties now. We know, of course, that Indiana Democratic Party Chairman John Zodic had some good things to say about him. And I noticed that, and we maybe didn't have a chance of getting a response back, but the Indiana Republican Party officials didn't say very much about it, I would imagine. But they did have, everybody had something good to say, it seems.
Yeah, it was hard to find people critical of him. Some people pointed to some campaign finance scandals from about a decade ago that never really amounted to anything formally, and if anything, kind of seems to have refocused Congressman Fisklosky on working for the region, getting things done in the region, as opposed to trying to be more of a national player in some things. Probably the biggest critic of him in recent years has been him and Mayor Tom McDermott, who had been fomenting a primary challenge against the congressman, and now is running for the seat without having to take him on.
Now, I know we mentioned here at the beginning of our conversation about the fact that about Mayor McDermott here, that there had been word, and you'd had stories, of course, in the Times about it as well, Dan, about this comment that McDermott made on his commercial radio station program that his campaign pays for on Fridays about the fact that it seems that Fisklosky was interested, I guess, in doing some type of information. I guess they call it opposition research, I think is what the official term for campaign-wise is. And so that's like I've got the clue that maybe that's why somebody was interested in this, because there's a possibility there might be a potential candidacy there, huh?
Right, yeah. It caused quite a splash. The congressman's campaign arm a couple weeks ago requested a ton of information about McDermott's tenure as mayor, going back all 15 years, how he, his expense reports, his salaries, how they've spent all the casino money. And the mayor publicized the receipt of that open records request and kind of pointed out that you don't do that kind of request unless you think you're going to be running against somebody. So maybe Pete saw that, he didn't want to, he's 70 years old, maybe didn't want to have this, huge intra-party fight, which is presumably towards the end of his career anyway. There's also some speculation that his chief of staff, Mark Lopez, whose wife is Fisklosky's campaign manager, might be looking at getting into the race as well.
Oh, so, I see. Okay.
Yeah. And don't forget, Visklovsky himself was a staffer for Adam Benjamin, the former congressman in this district before he went on to run for the office. Mm-hmm. So it's not unprecedented for that kind of move to be made.
Now, I know that in your story that you have lately out here about the people that are interested the most in possibly running for Congress, besides Mayor McDermott, and we'll talk a little about what he had to say as well, too. We know that Frank Mervan, in particular, from North Township, is interested in becoming a candidate, too. Tell us what you can tell us. What can you tell us about the candidates that at least have said they are definitely interested in running?
Yeah, right now, the definitely interested are McDermott and Mervan, and both announced within minutes of Pete's press release coming out saying that he wasn't going to run. They put out statements or went on the radio and said, yep, I'm running. So McDermott obviously makes sense because he had already been preparing a primary challenge. I talked to him yesterday. He confirmed what he described as the worst-kept secret in Northwest Indiana politics, that he was planning to run. He said he had an announcement ready to go on the 6th. He already has a campaign headquarters. It was updated yesterday with a McDermott for Congress sign one day after he got reelected as mayor. So you just paste over the mayor with a Congress, and he was ready to go.
Well,
so,
I mean, that means you had to have some kind of a paper sign to put up on top of it then. So you had to plan this ahead of time to be sure. These things don't happen right away, I know. And what does Frank Mervan have to say about his interest in running for Congress now, apparently?
Yeah, I sat down with him yesterday. He said he had been interested in running for Congress forever, that this is always something he had considered as a potential place for him to take his talents that he's used over the last 14 years as the North Township trustee and 3 years before that as a North Township board member. But he said he respected Congressman Visklovsky too much to try and primary him, but now if Pete's out of the way, Trustee Mervan said this is a perfect opportunity for him to get in the race, and it looks, he believes it's the best place for him to continue serving Northwest Indiana.
Now, the 1st Congressional District is a nice multi-county district here. Is there anybody else outside of Lake County, in this particular case, that you think, and if they haven't officially said so, might possibly be interested in running for Congress?
The district is all of Lake County, all of Porter County, and then western LaPorte County, sort of right on the border of Porter County, and then up the through Michigan City and up to the state line with Michigan. Mm-hmm. So I spoke yesterday with Jim Harper, the Valparaiso lawyer who was the Democratic Secretary of State candidate in 2018, and he said he's taking a look at it. Back in Lake County, State Representative Mara Candelaria Reardon, a Democrat from Munster, said she's potentially eyeing a campaign. Also, State Representative Reagan Hatcher, who had announced that she was going to run for Eddie Melton's Senate seat since he's running for governor.
Right.
But she said she's, leaving her options open to see maybe a better place for her is in Congress.
Well, it sounds like this is definitely going to be a very interesting 2020 Democratic Party primary election race, to be sure. And speaking of elections, let's take a look back here at the first of the week here. And I know that you had a chance to cover the town of Schererville and some interesting races that have developed there, too. With now we see a new clerk treasurer coming into office, a fellow who's shifting from the town council to working in the local building all the time now, isn't it?
Mike Troxell has been on the Schererville Town Council for the last 20 years. The current clerk treasurer in Schererville, Janice Malinowski, decided to retire, didn't run for re-election, so that created an open seat race, and Troxell was elected. Pretty close race, relatively speaking, over Mark Borst, the Republican. So Schererville will have, it's a familiar name within Schererville for, having given Troxell service on the council, so he will be taking over as clerk treasurer at the beginning of the year.
Well, and kind of tying along with what has happened here with the elections, just your brief observation here. You had a chance to take a look at all the data and all the returns in here. Any thoughts about how things turned out as far as the municipal races here, certainly in Lake County, are concerned?
Yeah, there were some surprises. Highland going Republican was kind of a surprise. Munster picking almost going Democrat was kind of a surprise, but you're starting to see these districts, these cities and towns change a little as the region becomes more explicitly suburban. You're getting more people moving in from Illinois, and suburban voters seem to be changing in their political outlook. You saw this in Indianapolis too, the Indianapolis suburbs. A Democrat was elected to the city council in Carmel, of all places. Zionsville, another strongly Republican area, now has a Democratic mayor. Fishers, which has been sort of this booming Republican town suburb northeast of Indianapolis, got a few Democrats on their city council. So, you know, things are changing. It's hard to know whether it's just a demographic aging of the voter base, or, you know, whether President Trump is turning off some traditional Republican voters and they're voting for anybody but him. I guess we'll see in 2020 as far as that goes. But, you know, there is a shift happening in some of these places, and places that had been one party for a long time are probably going to change quite a bit over the next few years. Now, you know, in a local race, it's hard to say whether partisanship matters as much. You know, there isn't a Democratic way to pave a street or a Republican way to pave a street. And, you know, even within these local governments, you hear them talk about how, you know, they're all more committed to getting things done than to focus on partisanship. It's just not the same kind of thing as at the national level. But, you know, it does matter to some extent, and we're in for interesting times.
That's to be sure. And Dan Carton, thank you very much for spending some time with us here on Regionally Speaking to talk about not only Congressman Pete Visklosky's big announcement and what may come to be a very interesting primary election race next year, as well as what's happened in the local races here this past week. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Anytime.
And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Each week, a group of insiders offers perspectives on this week's top stories. And this week, Inside Indiana Business host Gary Dick has a special panel that is sounding off on all things Northwest Indiana. Here's the conversation.
Well, the Port of Indiana Burns Harbor is one of three statewide ports located on Lake Michigan and situated on two major North American freight transportation arteries, the Great Lakes and the Inland Waterway System. The state's three-port system serves really one of the world's most productive industrial and agricultural regions. The port is also currently in the middle of a $20 million expansion here. 600-acre port, also home to more than 30 companies. And one day could be become a destination for cruise ships with tourists to explore Northwest Indiana. And it's time now for a special edition of The Insiders. This week, we're talking all things Northwest Indiana, from the Westlake Corridor Project to the focus on getting more people to move from to Indiana from Illinois, to how the region is stepping up its workforce development game. And I'm pleased to be joined by Gary Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson, also NIPSCO Economic Development Director Don Babcock, and South Shore Convention and Visitors Authority President and CEO Spiro Batistatos. And welcome one and all to The Insiders.
Thank you for having us.
And Mayor, I'll start with you. And you'll be leaving office at the end of the year. You're going to head up the Chicago Urban League, so a big job for you. But you have will be wrapping up two terms, 8 years. You've seen a lot in Gary in the region. How would you assess the state of the region as we sit here today?
I think the state of the region is very strong. I think we have come together cohesively in a way to focus on our assets, namely our commuter rail through the Westlake and the investment on the double tracking, tourism. You see, we're here in the Mascot Hall of Fame. We have really leveraged our lakeshore, the recreational side at Marquette Park and Gary and Portage and Michigan City, all along the lakefront. And so I think that we are working together extremely well, and it's really working to the benefit of all residents.
Do you sense that things are beginning to come together that maybe weren't happening to before? Collaboration, cooperation, some of these things you talked about are now beginning to get that snowball effect going.
Oh, that's absolutely the case. I think one thing is that we have the leadership of a very engaged congressman. He has been working hard to provide infrastructure and other things that we need here in Northwest Indiana from Washington, because you have to have a partner in the federal government. But you also have organizations like NERPC, like the Regional Development Authority, and like the South Shore Convention and Visitors Association. All of those organizations are working together so that everyone from Northwest Indiana is sort of on the same page.
Spiro, Mayor talked about, talent, attracting people from Illinois. I know you're engaged in that in a big way, among other projects.
I would, but before we leave this topic, I would be remiss if I didn't point out, and the mayor is always too humble and too much of a team player, but if the congressman were here, he'd tell you the very first person, the very first city on board with Westlake and the double track expansion was Gary. And you could have made an argument that said, well, we could prioritize our money differently. We have needs. And you know what? From the day one, Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson saw what's good for the region is good for Gary and vice versa. And to her credit, jumps in as a team player. So it's not just an observation. She's lived that throughout her career in this region.
I particularly appreciate, even from day one, her focus on inclusion and respect for diversity and different points of view in terms of how to advance the region and move the place forward.
Well, let's talk about the connectivity, because it's so important for all parts of the state. But Sparrow, I'll begin with you.
The move to Indiana is incredibly successful. Sure. We've been very fortunate. We have a number of municipalities coming in, seeing that it pays to advertise what's going on along those investments that are being driven by multiple layers of government. And we're seeing housing starts happening all over Crown Point, Schererville. It's just the housing stock in that side of the county is going crazy. I'm going to challenge everybody to take a fresh look at what's going on in the region on the South Shore, because there are hidden secrets and gems everywhere, not just in the communities that you hear about all the time.
Spiro's absolutely right. I've, in fact, talked to a number of insurance agents who have said, we are doing just incredible business, renters, people who are purchasing homes in the city of Gary, who want a quieter lifestyle, who want more of a family-oriented life, and they are looking all over Northwest Indiana, including Gary.
Don, it would seem all these things coming together. Right. The South Shore extension in a long time coming, 30-plus years maybe.
Oh, easy. And I was around when we first... My mom actually rode the South Shore from East Chicago, Indiana. We grew up in Highland. Yeah. Little 746-square-foot home. But she's the poster child of, and I'm the product of that, of being a little bitty house, drove every day to the South Shore Station, East Chicago, catching a train to Chicago for a better job, bringing the money home, and raising three kids.
Sure.
I'm a Purdue Northwest Indiana grad, first my family to go to college.
As you look at the perception of the region, too, all these things you're talking about here, that perception outside of Northwest Indiana to people looking here, it's a different, seems like it's a region in transition.
Well, it has changed. So I have to give the, I haven't done this yet, but good afternoon, Northwest Indiana.
I was running in the afternoon.
And I do that routinely because I think one of the ways to change communities is you really hang around with good people, people that believe in each other, listen to the naysayers relative to when they have something worthwhile to incorporate in the plan.
Sure.
But at the end of the day, you got to stay with the yaysayers. And we have a lot of yaysayers now in Northwest Indiana. We used to be pretty much described as the Rust Belt, and we're moving very much to the Green Belt.
Well, and you talk about the National Park designation.
Oh, absolutely.
For this,
That's
what does
huge.
That mean for this the region?
We are very proud of it.
There are 426 national something or others. Lakeshore, seashores, through you name it. There's 26 different monikers of national places. The funny thing is that nothing changed here. We didn't get any more money. The boundaries didn't grow. There aren't any more park rangers. One little four-letter word, park, took us from one of 426 to one of 61. Mm-hmm. And the cachet that that word brings with it, we saw this year throughout the region. Lake, Port of La Porte, all of us saw incredible, because the park touches all three of our counties. We saw incredible visitation numbers, record-setting years. Now we just keep working on spending. I want you to come in and visit the park, but I don't want you driving home right away.
Right.
So we have an opportunity to parlay from that national park into national brands of gaming loyalty and recognition that we didn't have before. While we had some pieces of the puzzle, which were doing great, we are not going to have that Hard Rock brand. And I'll let you kind of take it from there.
I mean, that's 30 seconds, Mayor.
That's incredible to have a partner in Hard Rock, to have it on the 80-94 corridor. It will take not just gaming, but development, related and unrelated assets, light years.
More of a destination. It's really what
it will become a destination.
Entertainment, restaurant. I mean, it's just all, you know, all
absolutely.
Of them. Again, we have great casino partners throughout the region.
We
so
do.
I don't want
we
any.
Absolutely
you know,
do.
This is just a final feather in that cap of great entertainment, live entertainment, and a brand. But that,
and we're going to get the linger longer. So right. come yeah. to visit and stay.
Yes.
You've got a future in hospitality. If you're
he does. He does.
With that, we'll put a wrap on another edition of The Insiders. Gary Merrick, Karen Freeman Wilson. Thank you. Good luck in your new.
Thank you.
Endeavor, your next chapter, Spiro Batistatos, also Don Babcock.
Hey,
thank
thanks,
you for
Gary.
Being here.
Great
and
job.
Thank
glad
you for
glad to have
here.
You up in the region. It's
thanks.
Wonderful.
It's great
so,
to be
thank
here.
You.
Thanks for being here.
That's Indiana, Inside Indiana Business host Gary Dick and his guests in a special All Things Northwest Indiana conversation that was aired on Inside Indiana Business Television and was also aired on Lakeshore PBS. Let's continue with Regionally Speaking's Reporter Roundtable Thursday and talk with Michael Gonzalez. He's a reporter for the Post Tribune. And this time around, he's talking about politics in Portage, being one of the reporters for the newspaper that put out stories on print, in line and on print about the recent municipal elections. Michael, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you had a chance to sit in and listen and watch a lot of things happening for the election night, I guess a watch party is could be best described, in Portage as candidates for mayor, including and other city and city council as well, too, had a chance to sit and wait for the numbers to come in. First, if you will, describe for us where things happened and the scene that you got to sit in on as everybody was waiting for the final results to come out.
Well, it was pretty dramatic, actually. You had John Cannon, the incumbent mayor, who's been in office since the Republican caucus selected him back in March. So at his campaign headquarters, he had a number of the Republican candidates and their families, and it was fairly festive. It was high energy, very good feeling, especially as the early numbers came in, because when the early numbers started coming in, beginning about 7:30 or so, it was clear that beginning at that point, it was clear for the first hour, hour and a half, that John Cannon had some momentum. He began by a point and a half down, a couple points down, and by 8 o'clock, a little bit after 8 o'clock, he was actually ahead of a couple of points. People were quite festive. When John Cannon walked in, he walked into a hero's welcome, as can be expected. And then later in that hour, the 8 o'clock hour, the numbers came in showing the early and absentee votes, and the situation changed. This sort of the energy just sort of left the room, because at that point, with those votes counted, Sue Lynch took a big jump up and kept a lead from that point on. I mean, we're talking, she went from 49% to his 51%, 8:06, and then at 8:41, it had flipped, and she was at 53%, and he was at 46%. So those early votes really came in, early in absentee votes. And then across town at the Woodland Park Hall, the Democrats were meeting, and there was a DJ playing and food and just a very, very festive atmosphere. And I happened to be there when Sue Lynch got noticed that she had, in fact, won the election. And it was pretty stunned. She was pretty stunned by that, but the crowd was just so energetic and so excited.
When you got over to the Lynch headquarters, or where they were actually, where they were getting together there at Woodland Park, was the atmosphere, I guess, changing? Did you happen to see by the time you got there, the more information came in, and everybody seemed to be more excited about how the prospects were going to be for Sue Lynch to win?
Well, by the time I got there, they'd already gotten word about the big jump due to the early and absentee ballots. Uh-huh. So by that point, Sue was already in the lead at 53 to 46, so she'd taken a big jump. So by the time I got there, they were already festive and they were already excited, and like I said, there was a DJ and dancing and all kinds of stuff going on there. But so when they finally announced it, the crowd of course just kind of went crazy and went wild, and we're quite excited and cheering, and not only for Sue, but also the Democrats swept the city offices. So the Democrats won the mayoral office. They also won the mayor's office. They won clerk treasurer, and they swept the city council as well. So you can imagine for the Democratic Party, that was a gigantic night.
I noticed in your story that you mentioned the fact that one of the supporters was able to kind of clinch it, at least as far as Sue is concerned, and showing the final numbers off his cell phone. So she obviously she was not quite ready for it, but she obviously had to be ready for the decision.
This was going, I think we all knew this was going to be a close race.
Yeah.
It was contentious. It was close. And she looked stunned at first, but it didn't take her long to gather herself up, because by the time she got a chance to speak to the crowd, the city council victors had already spoken and sort of prepped the crowd for her. So she was stunned. She was taken aback a little bit. And I think because those numbers were so close for the first part of the tallying, those numbers were so close that to see an actual victory and by a fair margin, I think she just had to let that soak in.
Well, tell us a little bit about what Sue Lynch had to say when she was with her supporters and had a chance to make some comments here. As you mentioned, the city council candidates kind of prepping the audience for it.
Well, I think the Sue has been on pretty much on message, on point with her message, talking about civility. And I think civility was the first thing she mentioned, actually. So she spoke about and the need for civility and stability actually going into the new year, because this is the fourth or the third mayoral change in 1 year. So by the time she takes office in January, she'll be the fourth mayor in 1 year. So she called for that civility and which is something that John Cannon later on would say that he was going to cooperate with her. But she called for civility, and fiscal responsibility has been a huge message for her as well as for the council candidate.
And you mentioned about the fact that John Cannon, I guess, obviously had something to say, or you were able to catch up with him after the vote totals came in and it was apparent that that Sue Lynch was going to be the winner. First, give us an idea of how the totals turned out there as percentages, so people get an idea, if they hadn't seen the story in the Post-Tribune, how much of a change that seemed to have been, apparently from John Cannon holding a solid lead, apparently, to the changeover.
Well, and that's a fascinating part of this. This was such a whirlwind kind of night. So, and I'll give you the exact times, actually.
Okay.
So, as the numbers were released, at 8.06 p.m., so the polls closed at 6, so 2 hours later, Sue was ahead, well, I'm sorry, a little bit earlier than that, 7.40 or so, Sue was ahead by, I think, a point and a half. By 8.06, so it's probably 20 minutes later, John Cannon had taken the lead, so he was up 51% to her 49%. And that's when the crowd and his party at his headquarters really just kind of went wild and very, very excited. And so at 8:41, when they flashed the new numbers, which included the early and absentee totals, it stunned that crowd. It felt like it stunned them, and you can almost feel the air leave the room. They'd been riding really energetically and really high up until that point.
And does it seem now that with the turnout, the results rather, turning around as they did, and that Sue Lynch is now the mayor-elect, you mentioned just a moment ago that the fact that she's pretty much stayed on message on how she feels that she, at least the administration that she's going to lead, is going into 2020 pretty much with some very set ideas. And I know that even when we had a chance to talk with her on election night on the phone from the celebration, that obviously she was most concerned about finances, and she pretty much, as you say, stayed on topic about that, that she wants to know first how the city of Portage is doing financially to be sure that they don't get something wrong and get themselves off mark, so to speak, when it's time to plan for projects going into next year?
Yeah, well, this has been critical for a couple of reasons. But first, let me just add this.
Yeah.
The final tally was Sue 52%, John 47%. And that's with all 27 precincts having reported in. So regarding fiscal responsibility, I think most people don't realize that Portage is in financial dire straits. By law, they present a balanced budget to the state, but they're probably going to carry over some debt. Now it depends on whom you ask. John Cannon feels like the debt has been fixed, and the city will be balanced by the time 2020 comes, and therefore nothing will be taken out of the 2020 budget. Almost everybody else disagrees. And so they disagree by a range of from almost $1 million, some as high as $4 million. I suspect the number is closer to somewhere between $1 and $2 million at this point. But again, they're still working on this. In fact, tomorrow there's a budget committee meeting to try to hammer this out. You don't want to go into the new year carrying debt, because that's going to affect, obviously, the money that you get from the state. So fiscal fiscal responsibility is going to be huge. I think that along with civility, I think Sue Lynch and John Cannon are both right when they say they have to get on firm financial footing. This is going to be a real burden for the city of Portage in this coming year.
I know, too, that besides the usual campaign issues that come up here and everybody's out talking from both John Cannon's standpoint as well as Sue Lynch's standpoint, we had the usual concern about potential hijinks and some very, very, very difficult words that I know that have been said between the candidates during the campaign itself that finally have kind of just gone into the history books, haven't they?
Yeah, well, the history books and a lot of current stuff. I mean, there was a lot of bad feeling going into this election, and I think it's going to take a little time to get over that. And I've reported on some of those things. For example, the city does a lot of business with the Operating Engineers Local 150. The city that's the bargaining agent for the city employees. I think almost 300 city employees. As well, the city gets its health insurance through that local at to like $4.5 million a year or something like that. It costs the city. Well, three officials from that union, separate on their own and not endorsed by Operating Engineers, launched a PAC called the Hoosiers for Accountability, which sent out a number of flyers just hammering away at Sue and suggesting she's not, in fact, fiscally responsible. And it was quite upsetting to a lot of her supporters. There was also some social media things going around about her age and being very negative about that. And then there was a claim of a racist comment made 4 years earlier. We didn't cover this.
Michael Gonzalez is reporter for the Post Tribune, and he's given us a great account of the story that he put in print as well as online here about the outcome of the Portage mayoral race and, in general, the municipal elections in the city of Portage. And you can go to the Post Tribune's website and take a look at the story, along with the other stories that staff members have put in as well, too, covering the elections in Lake Porter and LaPorte counties. You're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. There's a special documentary that's involved with Veterans Day that is coming up this evening, Thursday evening, on Lakeshore PBS that has been created by our next guest here on Regionally Speaking. Elena Milirisis is the director of a military family documentary, which is entitled While Time Stands Still. And Elena is with us. Thank you for joining us on the program today.
It's my pleasure to be here with you, Chris.
Well, first, I understand that there is a very personal connection that you have with military families that got you started in creating this documentary. Please tell us about it.
Absolutely. Yes, a very personal connection. My now husband was in the Marine Corps. And he deployed back in 2004, 2005 to Iraq. And so I went through combat deployment with him and realized that there really wasn't anything that spoke to the perspective of what families go through during wartime. So I was a producer, a journalist, a director, and I felt that I needed to create something that could tell the story of military families and celebrate their courage.
And I understand there was a program that you heard on NPR not long after your husband got back from Iraq that kind of led you into this idea.
Yes, in fact, you know, that is one of the things that I find so amazing about the work that we do in terms of in media, where I truly felt that I was helped by an interview that I heard on NPR. It was on a book called While They're at War by Kristen Henderson. And I felt like she was talking to me in the interview, so I ran out and I got the book. And it was about a year after my husband had gotten back from Iraq. And for the first time, I felt like I wasn't alone in the experience. And I felt that I probably couldn't have read a book during his deployment. That would have been a little bit too much for me because I was quite anxious and stressed out worrying about him. Mm-hmm. But I felt like I could have watched a movie. And being as how that was my background, I felt that that's how I could be of service to other military families and also let the greater population know what military families go through.
Now, how did you structure this particular film that you put out?
So it was important for me to do it somewhat chronologically because I thought it was important to see what families go through physically during a deployment. So you can sit with someone in a chair afterwards and they can say to you, oh, it was difficult. And it's not that they're not sincere, but for you, the viewer, to actually watch them, you know, what they look like when they haven't been sleeping, when they're losing weight, when they're gaining weight, and you incrementally see what that is like on a person, I think you can draw your own conclusions to the effect the deployment has. So I followed a couple wives during their deployment before, during, and after. And then I also interviewed spouses and parents from around the country to sort of get a whole picture of what that experience of a combat deployment is for a family.
Well, that you have the idea of the film, how did you find the folks that are actually in it now?
Well, I didn't do a lot of what's called casting. I had a production assistant agreement with the Department of Defense, and I knew someone out at 29 Palms, a Marine Corps base here in California, and they offered that I could speak to three families. And two of the families were going to stay in town and one was going to leave, and I really wanted to be able to do follow-up interviews during the course of the deployment. And so both of those women said that, yes, they would be happy to be a part of the project. And I said, okay, let's do it.
Now, did this idea happen to come, as you mentioned, because you had a loved one that went off to the war and came back, but did this perhaps maybe come a little bit too close to your personal journey?
It was difficult to do this film. And there were a lot of times where I actually wanted to just not keep thinking about deployment all of the time and the difficult parts of deployment. But one of the things that I realized is that there are some people that are not so lucky to have the choice of whether or not they want to think about deployment. Some people lose loved ones. Some people are caregivers for the rest of their lives. And those people, like I said, don't have a choice. And I felt in those times when I was getting whiny that I needed to just get over it and find the strength to keep going and, you know, do something for those families that were still in the thick of things. And, you know, we still have families who have loved ones deployed to this day. So it's not over for families.
Now, these journeys that you mentioned in the film, the documentary, which is entitled While Time Stands Still, did some of these things happen? Did they unfold as you had expected or thought they might?
Some things did. You know, people did have sleepless nights. They did have issues with, you know, stress and things of that nature. But really, the situation was actually a lot worse than I expected, and I don't mean to sound down about it. Mm-hmm. And one of the people in the film actually, you know, had a very difficult time. She went through postpartum depression. She had thoughts of attempting suicide and then actually did. And I don't mean to spoil it for anyone. She's okay. The important thing is that you can see how she managed to dig herself out of that situation. But these are the hidden costs of war that we mostly don't realize because families are so brave and they generally don't complain about what's going on in their lives. They're strong for everyone and maintain the family infrastructure at home.
Now, what kind of insights did you happen to gain while you were doing this film?
Well, one thing I realized, for one, is that we are stronger than we ever think is possible. And somehow, one step at a time, we make it through our difficult times. And I can't even tell you how inspiring it was to be with these women and families and seeing really how they were making it through one day at a time. I found that the people that did best in these circumstances were people that had a strong faith, and that could be in something like God, but it could also be in our reasons for being at war or just knowing that their loved one was living their best life and was in the right place for them at the time. And so people that had a faith and people that were not questioning why the situation was happening seemed to manage to avoid the most stress. And then if you knew at least one other person that was going through the experience, that made a huge difference for families, whether they had someone that they could call and talk to that could relate to what they were going through.
Do you think perhaps these were some of the most rewarding portions of the film that you've been able to put together?
For me, yes. I mean, I have to say one of my favorite parts is still when one of the guys comes home, because it's just this moment of just pure joy. But the fact of the matter is that the film is actually an inspiring journey of what it takes to go through difficult times and come out the other end. You know, so often on TV or in movies, we hear stories where it's like, I was homeless and now a millionaire, or and what's that in between time? You know, there had to have been something that motivated you along the way to keep going, that made you keep, even in those difficult times, that you were able to make those decisions that brought you to a better place. And by watching this film, you can truly see that. And it is a challenging journey and often takes a lot longer than anyone might expect to heal from the trauma that you go through during a combat deployment. But what everyone should know that is going through this and has been through it before is that it is possible. You just have to keep going.
Do you think these are some of the most important things that you're able to certainly take away by doing the film, but in turn to show to people that get to see the film why it's so important?
Yes, I think, first of all, I think everyone can get something out of the film in terms of whether you're a military family or not, just in the way of, like, anytime you have a difficult time or you're going through something, it might be a family illness or a particular situation where maybe your child is autistic or something, and you feel like you're alone in your experience. And you can see how people handle difficult, stressful times and make it through the other way. The other thing, though, that I think is vitally important that we see in this film is a person go through postpartum depression, because that is not something that we talk about very often in our society, and it's still shrouded in a lot of shame. And that is something that I really feel needs to come out in the public discourse more, and so that people can know that they need to get help at a certain point. And the fact is, you know, if you're pregnant, it's not a surprise. If your doctor can let you know that these are distinct possibilities in certain circumstances, specifically if you're a military spouse and you're pregnant, the rate of postpartum depression doubles if your partner deploys at any point of your pregnancy. So I think those are some, and also just in terms of, you know, being aware of possibilities of suicidal ideation and that kind of a thing for spouses. Because the more we know about these topics, the more we can prevent those situations from occurring.
Well, Elena, thank you for doing While Time Stands Still. Thank you for talking about it today. And I hope our viewers on Lakeshore PBS and our listeners on Lakeshore Public Radio that happen to watch the documentary tonight locally will get something out of it, too.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
Elena Mealy-Rissas is the director of the military family documentary that is entitled While Time Stands Still. Regional Health Systems President and CEO Bob Crumweed is retiring at the end of this year, and the Health Systems Board of Directors has naming Bill Trowbridge, who's the current president and CEO of Paladin, which is a Northwest Indiana Human Services organization, to be his successor. Crumweed has been with the organization for 30 years, and he's worked to expand services beyond the continuum of behavioral health care into addressing the socially related conditions in which people are born, grow, live, work, and age. He's also brought together organizations within the Regional Mental Health Center and subsidiaries like Geminis Corporation into what it is today. And along the way, Crumweed's received the Distinguished Hoosier Award from Governor Robert Orr and the Sagamore of the Wabash Award, which is the highest honor that a Hoosier governor can bestow, from Governor Evan Bayh. Bill Trowbridge has been with Paladin, which is based in Michigan City, since 2012, and that was when it is known as Michiana Resources. It supports individuals with disabilities, and he is also executive director of the ARC of Northwest Indiana. Jim McClelland, Indiana's executive director for drug prevention, treatment, and enforcement, is retiring. Jim McClelland was appointed as the state's drug czar back in January of 2017 through an executive order from Governor Eric Holcomb. He had previously retired as the CEO of Goodwill Industries of Central Indiana. And in a statement today, Governor Holcomb praised McClelland's work coordinating the state's Next Level Recovery Initiative. And he also announced McClelland's replacement is Douglas Huntsinger. Huntsinger is currently the Deputy Director for Drug Prevention, Treatment, and Enforcement, overseeing the operational aspects of the state's response to the drug crisis since 2017. And by the way, the retirement for Jim McClelland becomes official on January 9th, 2020. Four of the 10 school districts with the measures that have been on the ballot didn't get voter approval for school funding tax increases on Tuesday night, but Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay tells us how some of the votes did play out.
Two districts that lost proposed both construction and operations measures. Danville Community Schools was one of them. Superintendent Tracy Schaefer says now it's time to figure out next steps to keep more teachers, repair buildings, and improve busing.
And we have a need to replace 17-year-old buses. So they're safe for our children.
Meanwhile, Hamilton Community School Corporation Superintendent Tony Castle says with his district's referendum win, he's ready to get back to doing his job.
A lot of tears with parents tonight, with my wife. staff members just, you know, rejoicing that we're moving forward.
Scott County School District number 1 received approval for funding to build an elementary school, and Vigo County Community Schools also won voter approval for funding, while the district faces declining enrollment. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
My thanks from the Times of Northwest Indiana, Dan Carden, and reporter Michael Gonzalez from the Post Tribune for talking about the stories that they offered up in print and online today. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. And for this week, I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back with you on Monday.